Between now and Shavuos, I'd like to focus on Megillas Rus, or Ruth, depending on what language you want to use. We could be multilingual in here. Megillas Rus, we read on Shavuos. The connections between the book of Rus and Shavuos are, there are many connections, but they're not always so apparent. We have to discuss as we go along what those connections actually are. Kabbalat Torah is one of them. Certainly, you know, Rus is one of our most famous converts. She received the Torah herself in this story, so too much as we received the Torah. So my focus will not be Shavuos. The focus will be on learning the Megillah, understanding the message of the Megillah itself. But as we go along, we will see some connections between this Megillah and Shavuos that we will see. It's a very powerful story. Most of us have heard parts or the entire story, but we're going to try to go through it in depth, line by line. The story, in short, is about a Moabite convert who became the great-grandmother of David HaMelech, of King David, and ultimately the Mashiach. So it's an incredible accomplishment that somebody who came from a foreign land, who was an idolater, could achieve such a great accomplishment to become the great-grandparent of King David. It's an amazing thing. So we're going to see, we're learning a lot about her as to what did she do that merited such a standing in Jewish history. Who is she? Where did she come from? And what is in the story that really brings out, you know, the building and the forming of King David himself? Just to give a little context to the story, it occurred approximately the year 2787, which is 973 BCE in the English count.
How much?
973 BCE,
okay.
Or 2787 on the Jewish calendar.
Okay.
So we're talking about 3,000 years ago now. The time period it occurred in was, as the Megillah says, B'mei Shvot HaShoftim, in the times of the judges, of the Shoftim. This is before the reign of any Jewish king. This is the period in between the Jews entering the land of Israel, before Shaul HaMelech, King Saul, was appointed to be king. So we're in that period right now, the times of the judges, which is in the book of Shoftim, in the Tanakh. That's the book of Shoftim. Which period exactly in the times of Shoftim, we'll talk about more as we go through. But again, we place it historically about the year 973 BCE, which is 2787 on the Jewish count.
People can tell who was the judge at this time?
Yes, because Chazal associate Boaz with the judge Ivtsan. And we know a little about Ivtsan in Sefer Shoftim, so you can kind of place him and know what we're talking about. We also see the generations. We know how many generations went between this story and David HaMelech, so we can count the generations and figure out the year. The book of Rus was written by Shmuel HaNavi, Samuel the prophet. And the simple reason he composed this book, on a simple level, is to show us the lineage of King David. We want to know who was this person who's going to become the dynasty of the Jewish people, who's going to bring about the Mashiach. So we have to know where he came from.
Excuse me. It wasn't Shmuel who said Moavi velo Moavi when they say that she was she was not Jewish.
Well, part of what this book is supposed to show is that
but
concept.
But he was not the one who said Moavi, Moavia velo Moavi, that you can marry Moavia and not...
Right.
It was Shmuel.
I can't recall. I don't know who it was. So was it Shmuel?
He was kind of saying loud,
correctly.
Moavia,
I mean,
and lo Moavia.
We'll talk about, there was a controversy as to was a Rus allowed to marry into the Jewish people. The Torah says that you can't marry a Moabite, even a convert. So the book of Ruth tells us that there is certainly a license to marry a Moabite woman, not a Moabite man. That's part of the results of this book. So a Moabite man who converts cannot marry into the Jewish people. He has to marry only other converts or other people who are on the outskirts of the community, which, you know, we can discuss who those people are. A Moabite woman is allowed to marry immediately a Jewish man. No problem, as long as she converts. There's no prohibition upon her. But that's part of the controversy which actually surrounded King David and his lineage, and part of the intent of writing Megillas Rus was to counteract that controversy and say, no, I am Shmuel HaNavi, I'm Samuel the prophet, and I'm writing a book to show you the lineage of this woman, and it is totally permissible. No problem at all. So that's part of also the intent of writing the Megillas Rus. So the story begins. Let's start, we'll give the backdrop to it, but let's just start. We're going to try to read through it line by line. I'll read through it in the English just to make it more accessible for us all, but we'll refer back to the Hebrew as well. So the book begins, page 1269, and it happened in the days when the judges judged that there was a famine in the land. And a man went from Bethlehem, Beis Lechem, in Judah, to sojourn in the fields of Moab, he, his wife, and his two sons. So this is the intro to the book of Rus. So the context, the backdrop of this story is that Yeshua, Joshua brought us into the land of Israel. And at that point, all the tribes were living on their own, in their own tribal land, but there was no unified government which really governed the entire land of Israel. Each tribe had their own court system and had their leaders, but there was not any, it was like 12 different states functioning without any federal government, you know, overseeing it all. So certainly at that point, you know, everybody was supposed to be loyal to Torah and to God, that's for sure. And if the Sanhedrin made a ruling, everybody's bound by that ruling. But there was not any government, there was not any official political leader or any sort of government which ruled over the entire Jewish people. And what happened in this period was there were these people called Shoftim, judges. And those who learn the book of Shoftim always are a little bit confused. It's a little bit ambiguous who these people were. They kind of just kind of arise out of the rubble. They take it upon themselves to kind of fight on behalf of the Jewish people and lead the nation. And they did become accepted as leaders in temporary periods. But there was by no means any continuous leadership. And even the Shoftim themselves, each one had their own controversies and had their own issues. It wasn't a simple period. And these were not simple leaders. Everybody just said, you are now our leader, we're gravitating towards you. Each story is very, very unique and different as to who they were. So the period of Shoftim was actually a little bit, you know, tumultuous. You know, things then were not so smooth, not so clear. We had our ups, we had our downs. We had some very great Shoftim who ruled for many decades, and then we had times we had Shoftim ruling for only a few years or several months. Or, you know, in the Shoftim, in a sense, were kind of they were spontaneous. This kind of popped up. Now, sometimes through prophecy, sometimes without prophecy. But this kind of popped up to lead and to take on the leadership role of the Jewish people. So that was the backdrop of this story, the times of the judges. The Medrash points out that people during this time, you know, they were excited. You know, they had been slaves in Egypt for hundreds of years. They had been led to the promised land, and they had been given a very, very prosperous land. People were not supposed to get too involved in the material benefits of the land of Israel. However, the Medrash says that the people were blamed. You know, they neglected to give proper tribute to Yeshua when they first entered the land. And from then, because why? The Medrash says because they were busy in their vineyards, in their orchards, they're busy in the land. Because they saw how much prosperity could come from this land. So they neglected to give proper respect to Yeshua after he died. And then from then, it only kind of started going downhill, that people became a little bit too involved in the material world and did not give their proper respect to the leaders and to the great sages of the nation.
How long did it take to conquer the land?
It was a 14-year period of conquering and then divvying it up. So it was up to 14 years.
I think that there is a wonderful said Shvota Shoftim that the people judge their judges.
Right, yeah, so I'll get to that also in a second. We'll get to that too. That's right. And the Medrash says that the leaders and teachers of the Jewish people were supposed to travel around the land to all the different tribes and guide them and coach them and encourage them and give them the proper rulings so that they could live appropriately. So there was no government, but it was in the hands of the sages to sort of guide and lead. However, the Medrash tells us that those sages who should have proactively traveled around and led the Jewish people, they themselves also were also bound to their vineyards and their fields, and they weren't doing their job either. They kind of ignored their responsibility. This is what the Medrash tells us. This is what we see from our sages. So the period became somewhat of an anarchy. And it repeats over and over again the book of Shoftim. Bayamim ahem ein melech b'Yisrael. In those days there was no king. Ish hayashar be'enav ya'aseh. Everybody did what was right in their eyes. So if you leave it to what's right in our eyes, so sometimes it's right, sometimes it's not right. But there was no central leadership. The Shoftim, which we said before, they're unofficial leaders, they're temporary, but they didn't have the authority or influence that a king would have had. And the discussion of a Jewish king itself is an interesting discussion. Is that an ideal or not? Which is not for right now. But certainly the book of Shoftim, you know, the nation needed a king. They needed leadership. That's very clear in the book of Shoftim that over and over again, the Sefer tells us that they needed to have central authority and they didn't have, and that's why things kind of went haywire in many, many ways. Shvota Shoftim also could mean, like you mentioned before, that it was a time where they judged their judges. I mean, people did not give respect to the judges. It could be the judges didn't deserve respect based on some things we've said, but the people were not submitting themselves to the judges. The nation constantly fell into idolatrous traps and became, you know, subservient to other nations, came under attack until Hashem would send a judge and save them. But people did not live out, you know, the dream as they should have in Israel. know, they entered into Israel in this great, mighty conquest with Yeshua after the miracles of the desert, and they could have lived out the dream without a king and without all this turmoil happening. But unfortunately, it didn't happen that way. And the dismal setting of Megillas Rus is in this point right now. Megillas Rus is set in this context. So things are not in their highest of settings for the Jewish people at this point. Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky in Emes LeYaakov, he says that a king has the ability to make enactments in order to give guidance of how to deal even with things like famine. We're going to see in the beginning of this story that because of the famine, that's why they left the land. Mm-hmm. If there's a king, the king is in charge of the economy. He's the central figure, you know, in terms of the economy. And we find that the Gemara tells us that one of King David's daily responsibilities was to deal with economic issues. People come to him and say, your people need parnassa, we need to have sustenance. And King David would come up with plans to how to get sustenance. That was part of his daily job. Because there was no king, so the famine took probably a greater toll than it should have upon the land. So at this point, we enter into our story, and we see that it was the there was a famine in the land. It's time of the judges. There was no central king who had the authority to make enactments and try to run the economy appropriately. So therefore, what happened is that this family, Elimelech, which we'll see his name in a second, and his wife and two sons, they decided to escape, to leave the land of Israel, and go into the fields of Moab. Who was Elimelech exactly? Let's read the next verse, and then we'll go back. The man's name was Elimelech, his wife's name was Naomi, and his two sons were named Mahlon and Chilion, Ephratites of Bethlehem in Judah. They came to the field of Moab, and there they remained. So this family was the family of Elimelech. The first pasuk that we quoted, the first verse is Yoch Ish, calls him an Ish. The word Ish always denotes in the Torah something of significance. Chashivas, that's the word Ish. We don't need to say that a man went. Just say it, Vayelech, and he went, or Elimelech went. When you saw call somebody an Ish, that always denotes someone of significance, of importance. Elimelech is somebody who is both regarded as a leader, and also very, very wealthy. Mm-hmm. And he was looked at by all as a very respectable person and somebody that they should have been able to look towards during the famine. That's Elimelech. He was an Ish in Beis Lechem Yehuda. The term it uses to describe his children, Ephrasim. So the translation here was Ephratites. I assume means like, you know, I don't know, from Ephrat or something. But the also many companies render it as also meaning people of significance. The word Ephrasim also means significant people, mm-hmm. important people. And it was a very, very important family, which was in a position of power and of stature, both religiously and economically, and was destined for greatness. The name Elimelech itself implies Eli Melech, that the Malchus, the dynasty, could come from me. And it happened that way. The dynasty did come from him, but in roundabout ways. But in some way, he was the cause of this dynasty. But he should have been the great-grandfather of King David, and didn't turn out quite like that because of what he did over here in verse number one. But he is somebody that was in a position of power and leadership, but yet he abandoned ship. And this is one of the big blames that we cast upon Elimelech and his family. It says, "Vayelech ish," and he went to the fields of Moab. If you're somebody in a position of power financially and religiously, and your people are suffering, what do?
You don't leave them alone.
You don't leave them alone. Rashi says to us very clearly, Rashi tells us that because he was stingy is why he left. Mm-hmm. Everybody was coming to him for money. There's a famine, we need food, help us. And he couldn't deal with the pressure of everybody asking for his money and for his food. And he abandoned ship. Yeah. You know, that's what happened. A cat never abandoned ship, he abandoned ship. That's what Elimelech did. The Malbim points out, Malbim, another great commentator on the Megillah, he says that the poor people were actually taking from him by force. So it could be he rightfully felt mistreated. But even so, it's not the proper Jewish attitude to abandon when you have the ability to help. So whether the people who are poor were in the right or in the wrong by coming and requesting from Elimelech in very forceful ways, ultimately a man of that stature and of that greatness should not abandon ship. Moreover, where did he go? He went to the land of Moab. Moab is a classic, you know, nemesis of the Jews throughout the Tanakh. But beyond that, Moab is infamous in the Torah. The reason there's a special prohibition about a Moabite convert marrying into the Jewish people is because they did not come out and do kindness with us. When we were in the desert and we needed to have food and water, We went by the land of Moab, and they refused to give us anything. It says in the Torah, "Davar shel kidmu eschem lechem v'mayim," because they did not come out and provide you with bread and water. That's why they are castigated as a nation from the Jewish people. They're supposed to give us lechem and mayim, bread and water. They didn't do it. So when he goes out to Moab, what's he saying? What's the point that he's making? Is that I associate with them. Mm-hmm. Just like I'm not going to provide for my people in times of famine, I'm going to a nation which is infamous for not providing people in need. And that was part of what was his terrible offense, was that he didn't just leave, but he left to a nation that was blamed for the same offense he was blamed for. They were guilty just like he was guilty.
He was punished much.
The Torah, it tells us here, the Megillah first tells us, they went lagur b'stimuav. To lagur means, to translate here, sojourn, to live there temporarily. So he began, with his intents were not to stay there permanently. He went and said, I'll go temporarily until things kind of calm down in Israel, maybe I'll go back. But in verse 2 it says, Vayihi Yusham, there they remained, which has an implication that they, at a certain point, they decided that we're going to remain. So at first he went temporarily, like we had in the Haggadah a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
2 weeks ago now. The Haggadah said the Yaakov Avinu went to Mitzrayim, Lagorsham, just to temporarily sojourn there. We got stuck there for much longer than we intended to. But his original intent was, I don't want to abandon the land of Israel for so long. I'm going there because of a famine. Very similar story. But I'll go back as soon as possible. What happened over here, which also there is some reference to this in the story of Egypt as well, is that the Yusham, at a certain point, they enjoyed being in the land of Moab, and they decided to stay. They felt no remorse and no guilt for abandoning Israel and abandoning their people. Let's go to verse 3. It says in verse 3, Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. So Elimelech died. Why did he die? So certainly it seems to be a punishment. It's not explicit in the verses here. It seems to be a punishment for what he did. Number one, for abandoning ship, like we said, and leaving behind his people. But the Gemara also tells us that he should have davened on behalf of his nation as well. I mean, even if you could justify leaving the land of Israel, which, there might be justifications to that in certain ways, at least take responsibility that you're a leader, you're a great person, you're supposed to at least care, pray on their behalf, do whatever you can to help out the Jewish people. To totally cut yourself off, I'm not giving them money, I'm not going to daven for them, I'm out of here. That was his biggest offense. So the Gemara tells us that he's blamed that he gave up on the nation. He said, I give up on them, I'm no longer associating with them. And that was one of the worst things he can do. Many times in our lives, we can only do so much for others. We can always daven for people. That's something that everybody's ability to do. So not everyone has money or time or energy to help out, but davening is something easy to do. Yeah?
If you look at the Perkei Avos, first Mishnah, the emphasis for the Anshei Gedolah was that you be a proper judge.
Right.
You be true to yourself and true to the facts. And that would therefore bring honor to the Knesset, and it would also bring honor to the individual.
Right. So you're saying that when he says, I'm backing out.
Yeah, well, he was basically knocking the ground out from under the Anshei Knesset of Gedolah.
Interesting. Very interesting. It's one point which is emphasized in this verse. It says, Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died. Why is it repeated that he was Naomi's husband? So the commentaries explain that he could have been someone who was mourned by an entire nation. That was his stature. But because he abandoned the nation, the only person left mourning for him was his wife. Mm-hmm. That was it. So we're pointing out that when he died, all he was Naomi's husband. Finished. Mm-hmm. When somebody great passes away, they might have thousands of people mourning for them. But, he lost that because he abandoned the people. And he really had already died in their eyes long before. Everyone else in Israel, he'd already died in their eyes. Also, the wording here, it says, Vatisha'er he, she remained in her two sons. The word Tisha'er, the commentaries explain, also connotes the concept of Shiraim. They were just like leftovers. They were so poor and so downtrodden at this point. They remained as lowly people with a lowly status. So everything which they had, they essentially lost at this point. Yeah.
Did his sons mourn for him also?
I would assume so. I guess it's not as explicit.
But nobody died. I don't know how long after they
died. They didn't die yet. They were still alive. So
they died later.
Okay.
The comment pointed out is Naomi's husband, but you would have guessed the sons and mourn also, but I don't know. But either way, it wasn't the nation. It was just his immediate family, and that's all he had left for himself. In verse 4, what happens? So it says in verse 4, they married Moabite women. So now it gets even worse. So you would think at a certain point they'd get the message. Like, you know, we were very established, successful, respected people. We left the land of Israel, we lost our money, and we lost our father. Maybe God's sending us a message. Maybe. Right? God sends messages to us. But they didn't get the message. They lost, and Rashi tells us, they lost their father. They lost their money. They lost their animals. And then we're going to lose their lives. Mm-hmm. But God was giving them a progressive message, you know, step by step. Look, I'm showing you something. You did something wrong. Do tshuva. Come back to Israel. Help your people. But they didn't get it. So, you know, often in our lives also, Hashem will send us messages that we miss, you know, very often. These are very clear messages being sent to Mahlon and Chilion, and they missed the message. So not only did they not go back, they actually married... Now, they intermarried, Moabite women. These, according to most opinions, they did not convert at this point. They were full-fledged Moabite women. It was intermarriage. One named Orpah and the other Ruth. And they lived there about 10 years. So Mahlon married Ruth and Chilion married Orpah. And then they lived another 10 years in the land of Moab. And just to go back to our point before, now the wording changes. We first began with Lagur. They went to sojourn. And then it says Vahayu, that they remained there. And now it says Vayeshvu, that they settled down there. So they had made the decision, okay, we're here for the long run now. This is it. You know, we're full-fledged Moabites. We're not going back to Israel. We have our Moabite wives. And we're finished with the Jewish people. That was their statement, a very, very tragic and powerful statement.
Excuse me, Mahlon and Chilion, their real names. Because Mahlon is sickness, Chilion is destruction. Uh-huh. What kind of names are they?
Yeah, why did they get such a name?
It's a good question.
Terrible names.
You know,
maybe it shows at the end of...
They're given two other names also in Divrei Hayamim, which are also negative names. They're called Saraf and Yoash. Burnt and dejected. I would assume these are the names that were given to them just in the Sefer to show who they were. I would guess it's not their actual names. They're given by their parents. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know how a Jewish parent would name their kid Chilion, destruction. Like, doesn't really make sense.
It was a terror.
Indicative of the times.
I guess so, but you know, you don't want your kid to like be a represent those times, you know. Like, this is my kid Mahlon, this is my kid, you know, illness and plague, this is my kid destruction. Like, you know, this doesn't quite fit the typical names we would give.
Right. What happened to them?
I mean, we do have a concept that a name represents the essence of a person, but it's just hard to believe that was a name that was given to them at birth, you know. So I would assume these are the names that were coined based on who they were as people in the story, but not necessarily their actual birth names on the birth certificate. That's my guess. I don't know for sure. Yeah, exactly right. Those also seem to be names which imply who they are, but not
because it was Yiddish.
Yeah,
they gave up hope on
them. Right, and Saraf and burnt and incinerated. You know, that's their names. But they really reached a new low at this point, Mahlon and Chilion, and this is who they were. You know, they're people who represent to us the destruction, full-fledged assimilation. Giving up on their people. They were a total loss from their nation at this point. That's who they were. So we've seen in four verses a family which could have been, you know, held up as the greatest family of the Jews, the leaders, the supporters, people who are destined for giving birth to the Jewish king in Mashiach, and they've been driven down into the depths at this point. You know, there's nothing left of them, essentially. Which is part of the incredible thing that Rus will arise out of this mess, you know, because right now she's in a mess right now. That's what we have it right now. Mm-hmm. And so let's go to verse 5. The two of them, Mahlon and Chilion, also died. So after 10 years, they died as well. And the woman was bereft of her two children of her husband. So poor Naomi, she was left by herself. She lost her children, lost her husband. She was all alone.
No grandchildren.
No grandchildren, no nothing. She has two Moabite daughters-in-laws. All she has to show for herself right now. Yeah. No money, no nothing. That's all. And we'll see later on. And she's totally ashamed to return to the land of Israel. I mean, she abandoned them. And she's going to come back, you know, as a poor beggar. with nothing to show for herself. You know, for her, she's totally distraught, she's totally embarrassed of where her life has gone. And just to point out again, in verse 5, it says the same word about Tisha'er, which we said implies she's just the remainders, the leftovers. Because now she has a double leftovers. I mean, she's lost even more. But on the other hand, as we were talking about names before, her name is Na'ami. Noam is pleasantness or sweetness. Mm-hmm. And that connotes to us, that implies to us that she was somebody, we don't know much about her in the story quite yet, but she seems to be a little bit above her husband and children in terms of her ideals. I mean, she went along with her husband, but she is called Na'ami. You know, her kids were called Machlon and Chilion. She was called Na'ami to show that she was somebody of sterling character, as she certainly also made a mistake by going along, I assume.
Yeah.
But her character also remained very, very pristine. She remained a sweet, pleasant person despite everything happening around her. And that's who Naomi was. And we're going to see how inspirational a figure Naomi can actually be.
Right,
Naomi, exactly. Right, the ways are ways of pleasantness. That's Naomi. So that's who Naomi is. And right now, poor Naomi is, you know, she's left out in the dirt with nothing. Let's look at verse 6. She then arose along with her daughters-in-law to return from the fields of Moab, for she had heard in the fields of Moab that Hashem had remembered his people by giving them food. So Naomi is somebody, like we said, she's full of potential, she's pleasant, she has great midos, a great character. She experienced a lot of suffering. But now Vatakam, the word Takam implies she picked herself up. I mean, it wasn't just that she went, but she said, okay, I got to get out of the dust, pick myself up, dust myself off, and get back to life right now. She wasn't going to let this drag her down. She wasn't giving up hope. We'll see that she is a little bit depressed and bitter. We'll read about that soon. But she knew that there still is potential. There's still something I can accomplish. I need to go back to Israel. I need to change my life. I need to reconnect my people. She's been in Moab all these years as well, isolated and alone. That's where she's been. So Vatakam, despite her shame to return to the land, and despite her current situation, this is a big turning point. Because she's able to pick herself up. And she perceived something very important over here. She perceived, Kipakar Hashem es Amo, as it says in the Hebrew, that Hashem had remembered his nation. So she now sees that this all is a result of providence, of Hashkacha. She wasn't just going back because I'm going back for some food. I mean, she was also poor and needed food. But it says she's going back not just because there was Lechem in Israel, but because she heard that God had remembered his people by giving them food. So we see some sort of religious awakening in Naomi as well, which she probably lost over those years in Moab. Mm-hmm. She's going back now to perceive God and to reconnect her people because she sees the divine providence in everything happening to her and to her and to the people in the land of Israel. So that's Vatakam. Just by the way, I forgot to mention, a lot of what I'm sharing is coming from this great commentary on Megillas Rus called Nachlas Yosef, written by Rav Yosef Zev Lipovitz, who I believe he lived fairly recently.
It's in Hebrew?
It's in Hebrew, yeah.
Wow.
And it's a beautiful, beautiful commentary.
Where do you get it?
Rabbi Lopiansky is very into this commentary.
Oh.
And he talks about it yearly in the yeshiva.
He mentioned somebody in Israel who was a very special character. Every
he lived, I think, in Tel Aviv or something.
Yeah, in Tel Aviv.
Right, this is the one. So you've heard
every
this, yeah.
Year he speaks about Shavuot,
right.
And exactly. He mentioned this writer.
So it's a beautiful commentary.
He loves it.
I don't know if it's still in print in stores, but it's available for free online, HebrewBooks.org. That's where I found it. I printed it out myself.
Is it a language or very heavy language?
It's not so heavy.
Not so heavy. Okay.
What is the name of the author?
The author is Rav Yosef Zev Lipovitz. It's a very beautiful commentary. It really you know, pieces all the ideas together. Nachlas Yosef. I just want to attribute a lot of what I'm saying is coming from this sefer. So I want to make sure that everyone knows the sources. It's Nachlas Yosef. What?
No translation.
No translation. Nachlas Yosef, the heritage of Yosef. I mean, his name was Yosef. But I don't know if a translation is available. It could be there is. I don't know. But
you can
Google
that
it.
On the computer?
I got this at HebrewBooks.org. Which there they have an online archive of thousands and thousands of svarim that are no longer under copyright because they're older svarim, and you can print them for free. Yeah, so I printed it. I had it bound at Staples, and I have one now. I tried finding it in stores, but it's not printed in stores anymore. So I said I'll take care of it myself. So that's the commentary. So let's go to so Naomi is deciding to go back to the land of Israel, and she has with her now her two daughters-in-law, who are Moabites. And it says that she left the place where she had been, it's verse 7, accompanied by her two daughters-in-law, they set out on the road to return to the land of Judah. So it's pointed out that they set on the road literally means that they had no shoes even. They were so poor, they were walking directly on the road.
Wow.
I mean, they had nothing left. I mean, this is... people compare the story of Naomi really to another Eov, another story of Job, because everything was lost.
Because when Eov heard the terrible news, it also was in order like that. First they lost the horses, then
right, the money,
then the children died.
Right.
So it's kind of the same.
Right, so she really is a female version of Eov in many ways.
So weren't the women princesses, daughters of the king of Moab?
Yeah,
at least one of them.
Right, they both were, so that's interesting. You know, both Rus and Orpah were daughters of the king of Moab, they're royalty. However, it seems that they were so poor. My guess on the source of this is that being that they married Jews, their father disowned them also, right? From both ends, you know, Jews that are married to the Moabites, and they're disowned by the Jewish people, and Moabites married these Jews, they're disowned by their father. Because clearly, as they travel, they have nothing, and at this point, they're totally poor. If the king who was her mechutin wanted to give her money, he could have, you know. So I guess he did, you know. So that...
if he was Moab, you wouldn't expect it.
That's true also. That's true. So they set out on the road to return to the land of Judah. So and Rashi points out here something very interesting as well. We know that in the Parshas Vayetze, when Yaakov leaves from the house of his father and goes to his uncle to Lavan. So Rashi tells us, you know, when somebody righteous, when a tzaddik leaves the city, it makes an impression on all. And the city loses its splendor and loses its greatness because the tzaddik has left. So Rashi tells us the same thing about Naomi leaving from Moab. That even in Moab, despite the fact that she was this poor Jewish lady, people recognized her as a righteous woman. And when she left the town where she was living in Moab, also, it says Panaziva, you know, the splendor left and the glory left, and you know this aura of righteousness that Naomi had left when she left the land of Moab. So that's this idea of a tetze that she left. So they went on the road to get back to the land of Yehuda, of Eretz Yisrael. So one important question to ask is, why did these daughters-in-law go with her? What do they want exactly? I mean, like we said, they were royalty. Even if they were disowned, I assume if they cut themselves off from Naomi and went back to their father, maybe he'd help them out. But they had everything they're familiar with in the land of Moab. Their family, their friends, their religion, everything was there. So they wanted to marry these nice Jewish boys, so they did. The husbands unfortunately died. So why would they want to accompany their poor, destitute mother-in-law back to Israel? What were they in for? What were they trying to gain from this? And one thing you see here is a very important point. We see that Naomi had a magnetic draw, meaning what was the influence that she had upon them? They saw their mother-in-law and they said, she is such a special woman. We have such respect for her. She is so pleasant and so refined and so kind and so loving. We can't depart from her. That's what we can't part from. And that's why they went back. They weren't going back. They didn't have any religious feelings yet. They had no exposure to the Torah, to God, to Jews. They'd never met any Jews before besides Naomi. And it's pointed out that not even Jewish merchants came through Moab this time because there was a famine going on. They had nothing to sell. So it's not like they had any exposure to Jews. Their only exposure to a Jew was to Naomi and to their dead husbands. And that exposure was enough to encourage them that we're going to drop everything here in our homeland, our family and our friends, all that we're used to accompany her. She's such a special woman. This is part of the power that somebody living a proper life can have on others. We'll talk more about this later. But that's all they saw. And that was enough to draw them to want to accompany her back to the land of Israel. If we look, and we'll do a few more verses here. If you look at verse 8. So Naomi sees this happening. She sees that her daughters-in-law are accompanying her. And she says to them, then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go return each of you to her mother's house. May Hashem deal kindly with you as you have dealt kindly with the dead and with me. So she discouraged them from coming. It's pointed out that it says, Shtei Kaloseh, her two daughters-in-law, that she spoke to them both equally. I mean, we're going to see a split. Rus will accompany her, and Orpah's going to go back. So don't think that she showed favoritism to Rus. She didn't. She spoke to them both equally. The difference was in the personalities of these two women, which we'll talk about, you know, in a few verses. But she spoke to them both, and she said, go home. Now, why are you coming with me? And well, she gives them a whole speech we'll see in a minute. I have nothing to offer you. I don't know why you're coming with me. And there's sort of an implication that she's only concerned for their well-being, not for her own situation. I mean, for her, I'm sure the companionship of these two nice young ladies meant a lot to her. But she was somebody, again, who cared for others, had a sterling character, a great midos, and she wasn't going to have them come along when it wasn't good for them. And she felt, it's not good for you to join me. You have a lot for you in the land of Moab. Don't follow me, a poor old lady. Go back to your people, and I'll go on my own. And, you know, thank you very much. I appreciate your kindness that you've supported me, and you've come along with me, accompanied me, but God will pay you for that. But no reason to come along. Now, part of the undertones of this verse, I think, are twofold. Number one, when she says lechna shovna is the wording in Hebrew. Go, return, a double language. Mm-hmm. And one idea pointed out is that she didn't want them coming along, because imagine how embarrassed she'll be when she returns, not only in her state, but with two non-Jewish girls, daughters-in-law. You know, she's going to pronounce to all, my sons have intermarried, and here are my proud daughters-in-law over here.
No money, no name. No.
So deep down, it could be she didn't want to, you know, she herself felt so ashamed to return as is. And her family had gone from this very respected and prosperous family into nothingness. And to come back with her two daughters-in-law who are not Jewish, that's something which, you know, she also didn't want to have with her. That's one implication. Also, we'll talk more soon about the concept of conversion, but we know that we do not encourage conversion. Mm-hmm. And part of her saying go back is to test them. You know, if you're going to come back with me, you're going to have to convert. And are you sincere about this? You know, there's no reason to come along with me. And she's going to continuously discourage them for the next, you know, few verses, and it kind of weeds out, you know, who is sincere, who's insincere. But she does, at this point, say to them both, I'd like you to go back home. Don't come with me. You've dealt kindly with me and with my sons, and have a nice life. Let's go to verse 9. May Hashem grant that you may find security, each in the home of her husband. So, you know, may God find you both a nice shidduch. You know, that's find your own, you'll find a new husband. She kissed them and they raised their voice and wept. So she gave them a kiss and they both raised their voice and they cried. They didn't want to go. And this really is where we'll see in a second that, let's read verse 10. They said to her, no, we will return with you to your people. So this really was their initiative to convert. We're going to come back to your people. We're going to become part of your people. We're going to return with you. We don't want to go back. And we're going to see in a minute they're going to part ways, that Orpah will go back to Moab and Ruth will come along with her. But at first, both of these women had the drive to return, to go to Israel and become Jewish. The decision will change for Orpah momentarily, but that's where they are right now. And she tells them, I guarantee if you go back, God will reward you. No, you're in good hands, but I don't need you to come with me. And they said, no, we want to come back with you to your people. And again, their only exposure to the people before was Naomi. And we see that being exposed to a Jew is living life, you know, in appropriate ways is very inspirational. And they said, we want to become part of your people because we see people produced you. And if you could produce such a product, we want to be part of that people as well. And that's they're telling Naomi. But Naomi said, turn back, my daughters. Why should you come with me? Have I more sons in my womb who could become husbands to you? Turn back, my daughters, go along, for I am too old to have a husband. Even if I were to say there is hope for me, and even if I were to have a husband tonight, and even bear sons, would you wait for them until they were grown up? Would you tie yourselves down for them and not marry anyone else? Meaning, even if she could conceive a child, you're going to have to wait a little while until he's a marriageable age. You're going to wait around all that time? You two are nice young ladies. No, my daughters, I am very embittered on account of you, for the hand of Hashem has gone forth against me. So this is what she says to them. So she's like, I have nothing to offer you. Joining me is essentially giving up hopes of your future. You're going to be poor, Moabite converts in Israel as well. I don't have any children to offer. I don't have any wealth to offer. And I'm not going to have any respect when I get there because look at me. Look what's happened to me. I've been judged by Hashem, and my lot is bitter. And for you to join my lot, I don't see what you have to gain from that. So we see again that despite all of this, Rus is going to cling. I think we'll talk about that. We'll do that next week, that next verse. But Ruth is going to cling for her. And it's all because, again, this is another point made by Avraham Kamenetsky and Emes Liakov. You know, when you want to influence somebody, there's two ways to do it. You can teach and give them a message directly,
character.
Or you can live the message and they'll pick up on it. So Naomi didn't teach. She wasn't teaching them. But the influence which she had upon these girls is based on her life and her character, her honesty, her midos, her caring, her loving. And that, the way she conducted herself and lived her life, that had such a profound influence on these two girls that despite everything she just told them, I have no more sons and I have no more hope and I have no more money and I'm ashamed and I'm downtrodden, people are going to make fun of me when I return. Even so, they said, we want to stick with you. Because this is an important lesson we can all take. You know, if we live life appropriately, when we talk about the Jews being the light among, a light to the nations, so it does not mean that we're going to pick up and go out and teach every nation. That's not what it means. We actually, certain sects might do it, but typically Jews do not go out and proactively teach non-Jews about Torah. We don't proselytize. And so how are we supposed to be the light to the nations? And the answer is because if we're living our lives in appropriate ways, with honesty, with care, with love, devoted to God, devoted to the Torah, with good midos, that will automatically influence others. It will just rub off. That's the idea of being the light unto the nations. And that's what Naomi did. Naomi was able, through her conduct, she actually pulled out from the land of Moab this spectacular person, Rus, who's going to end up being the great-grandmother of the Mashiach. But not because she taught her Torah or gave her any sort of lecture, but it's because she has lived life appropriately and there was a magnetic effect and Rus was drawn to her. So then we'll stop here for now. So next week we'll continue with Rus's response. That'll be for next week.
I love this word.